Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Fringe Show. I am your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you this fine Tuesday?
Getting by, Nick, getting by.
Good spirits, I see. And also, of course, I don't know, what adjective am I going to use? The magnanimous Ms. Sargon.
I magnanimously issue my good Jewish New Year wishes to everybody.
Ah, very good, very good. Right. Let us start off with the first story today. Oh, yes. And as it turns out, we talked a little bit, I just do want to mention this briefly, we talked a little bit yesterday about the comments Helen Ziller had made about how the candidate list had been reopened by the IEC and how this would be really stupid and unfair if it happened. Well, unfortunately, it happened after we recorded the show, which is something we will probably be talking about later in the week again. Anyway, our first story for today is about ShopRite, the retail group. They own groups of shopping centers, grocery stores around South Africa. And of course, Checkers, I think, is one of their biggest ones. They posted a strong set of results for this year, saying that they had improved their profit margin by 55 basis points. And a lot of this was driven by the fact that they've had 1.5 million downloads of their 6060 delivery service app. But they did also talk about some of the damage that was done to their stores during the riots in July. ShopRite said that they had 231 stores significantly damaged during the civil unrest in KwaZulu-Natal and Gauteng in July. 83 of those remain closed. 47 of those were significantly damaged by fire. And 6 of them are definitely confirmed to not be reopening. So it's an interesting story. Let me start, I think, with you, Sara. It's an interesting story because it kind of shows the paradox of South Africa, where, you know, on one hand, we've got riots that are destroying people's lives and causing damage. But at the same time, you know, businesses and civil society sometimes manage to kind of pull through. What do you make of this? And what do you think it says about the country?
Well, I think it by and large says very good things about the private sector and by and large says very poor things about the public sector. I mean, it's impressive. I think Whitey Basson really got ShopRite Checkers into a space that was so good from a business point of view. And it seems to a large extent to be carrying on. They're innovative. I mean, all the grocery stores went online, so it was deliveries because of COVID. But they seem to have responded to the call. And the fact is that to be successfully, you actually have to be really efficient and effective. If you're too slow and you get sort of lists wrong or something, people are going to migrate to other stores. The sort of people who go online will expect that sort of service, and they seem to have provided it, which I imagine will largely remain untouched for this foreseeable future, particularly because you've got stores being burnt down as a result of mostly government ineptitude in handling a crisis that they should have foreseen. But I think it's very positive that they could post such a successful set of results. Given COVID, they took advantage of what it could offer innovatively, and given the fact that the enormous, over 200 stores damaged is a lot of stores, and all the credit to them that is not breaking their bank. Nick, you're muted.
Sorry, don't make that mistake often, but I do sometimes. Terence, I want to get your thoughts on this as well, but I also want to just bat back again a very stupid argument that one sees all the time in the mainstream media, especially during the riots. There were people on, I think, some of the big radio stations like 702 saying things like this, so it's not a completely ridiculous argument as far as the mainstream is concerned, and that is that the riots weren't such a big deal because they are covered by, the big shops are covered by insurance. Well, firstly, there were a lot of people who were not insured, who lost property to the riots. But also, and this is pointed out in the ShopRite profit reports here, that while a lot of the damage was covered by insurance for them, they've also lost an enormous amount of money having to pay additional security to protect stores from being destroyed, as well as from the stores being down, and basically they still are waiting for some of those insurance payments. So, Terence, your thoughts on that and also on this issue in general?
Well, look, as someone who, regrettably, from time to time has had to seek the services of my insurance carrier, I can tell you that it very seldom covers everything. But you know, that is such a pointless, foolish, stupid argument to make. An insurance service is there for an occasional emergency, not a sort of backup. You know, when society stops functioning and we face the zombie holocaust, you know, you are dealing with a fundamentally different situation there. Think about the days that you lose because of trade, because the place was gutted. Think of the wages you're unable to pay. You know, think of what that means for your premiums long term, and how that starts to sort of chew into whether you're a viable proposition. The same might have been said if you remember the Rorten Clicks about a year ago, where the EFF went and trashed shops. Oh, well, you know, people are upset, and you know, one can sympathize with that. But you know, they're insured, and this is, you know, white monopoly capitalism or whatever. Well, yeah, you know, the message that this perhaps sends to Clicks or Checkers or whatever, that perhaps you're better just being a fortified online only a retailer, with distressing implications for all of those ladies who work at the tills, for, you know, the guy who manages the meat counter, and the people who are off the floors. I know that the argument is going to come back, no, these aren't quality jobs, but you know, they're kind of the jobs people have. Without them, you have rather than a low quality job, you have a no quality job. You know, and I'm going to commit TDF heresy here and quote Rebecca Davis. I know, you know, she probably wouldn't like it either. You know, she said after the riots, you know, what is the point of government? And, you know, and she said something very, very interesting. She says, there's something wrong with being defined by your resilience. You know, wouldn't it be nice if, you know, business could not be defined by resilience, but by profitability or by growth, or by, you know, I left my shop here last night and it's still here the morning after. And I think that this was something that the private sector, if they haven't, and I, you know, something tells me they haven't, but they needed to communicate to the government after the Click saga, after H&M, and after this, that, you know, you want economic expansion, you want to create jobs. You know, we must create jobs, which. You know, in the real world means you actually have to have investments, and you have to have profit margins that justify it. Well, you know, a basic tenet is that you have to be able to sort of protect the physical plant. The idea that that, you know, we are going to create jobs while you know these places get looted and the cops sort of stand haplessly by. And I'm actually not ripping into the cops here. I mean, it was just like, I was trying to, like, you know, stop a tsunami with a little plastic bucket. But the dog and pony show that governance has become in this country, produces a situation where effectively the writ of the state does not run. Well, I mean, you know, is that something you want to sink your money into? I'm not so sure.
Exactly. I think it also, and you kind of brought this up, it illustrates a really important point, which is there's this lie pushed by people who are in favor of expropriation without compensation, that, you know, property rights really are just for the middle class and they just protect the rich and the well-off and that kind of thing. But what we saw during the riots was, of course, the temporary abolition of property rights in many places. And the result is, well, in the case of Checkers, it looks like they're going to be focusing perhaps more on their customers who can afford delivery fees and live in areas that there wasn't any rioting, which tend, of course, to be usually more well-off. And at the same time, they're going to not reopen stores in some of the poorer areas. So precisely the people who EWC people say would not be affected by the destruction of property rights are probably going to be hurt at the worst. Not to mention, of course, all the people who work in those shops and will lose their jobs, the cleaners and cashiers and security guards and all that sort of thing. Sarah, any final thoughts on this? Yeah, go ahead, James.
Just remember that when the ability to enforce property rights falls apart, the people who are going to suffer the most, going back to your original point, are those who don't have insurance.
Right, right. Sarah, your final thoughts?
It's sort of it's reflected in what we've said and some of the comments from audience members. But I dealt with a set of figures the other day that there is an undeniable horror in it. I think it was in 2001, for every 313 people with jobs, you had 100 people on social grants. Now, for every 100 people on social grants, you have 89 people with jobs. So it's our situation is appalling, but the minute anything like, certainly whether they're a small shop without insurance or a chain like Checkers with insurance, the minute something like this happens that the government handles very badly, people are just going to lose jobs. And right, probably by this time next year, that number of 89 to 100 will be worse.
So I also quite like the point that Terence made earlier about, you know, resilience. And wouldn't it be nice if instead of
Rebecca Davis. Aloes
plant, Rebecca Davis, sorry. if instead of taking an aloe plant to Parliament to talk about how tough we are and how we can survive with so little, the finance minister was talking about how much bounty we have and how easy it is to keep a surplus. Anyway, let us move on to our next story. And this is a case of, well, the reason we're talking about it is at least in part because it's an exciting story, but also because of gross nepotism, and that is that this story was passed to the media by my father, who's a dear MP. And it relates, it was, I think, discovered by a DA councillor in the area. And it relates to the funeral of a senior Mkhonto Sizwe veteran, Kebi Mapotso, during the weekend. Kebi's funeral was held at West Park Cemetery in West Dean in Johannesburg. And reportedly, according to people in the area, as part of the ceremony, there was a firing of guns in salute to, you know, the fallen comrade. However, while most would assume that in such a case people would use blanks, it appears that this may not have in fact been the case, because a old woman, a woman called Margaret Holloway, who's 76, was sitting outside at Euphius Old Age Home in West Dean when she was hit in the leg by a bullet. Now, it's alleged that the bullet comes from an AK-47, but this is still under investigation, so we don't know that for sure. There was also another old person whose house, apparently the window was broken by a bullet coming through it as well. According to the lady's son, she was sitting still in her wheelchair when the bullet hit her leg. They have not removed it. We are now told they will not remove the bullet and she will be discharged when she went to Helen Joseph Hospital. This apparently happened between 4:30 and 4:45 on Sunday. DA MP James Lorimer said that, quote, the sheer irresponsibility of firing multiple live rounds into the air in a densely settled area is difficult to believe. The fact that it was the funeral of a one-time senior member of the ANC government speaks volumes about the type of organization the ANC has become. Now, when I was an elected representative, this was actually in my ward, and I know that this is not a new problem. There was routinely cases where MK vets were being buried at that cemetery, or sometimes even gangsters being buried there, had gun salutes from attendees of the funerals, and often these appear to have not. These sometimes appear to have had live ammunition in them. Well, this is the first time I've actually known someone to very definitely been hit. It also appears that there were senior police officials at the funeral, and they appear to have not intervened. So not only has Metro Police been aware of this for a very long time, but the police who were there seem to have done nothing about it. Terrence, this is wild. What are your thoughts?
Yes, like, I'm not sure where one goes with this. Crassly stupid irresponsibility, perhaps. You know, it's sort of gun management 101. A bullet has to go somewhere. You fire the damn thing in the air, it's going to come back to earth. Now, I'm not sure whether it's true that it comes down with more kinetic force than it leaves the barrel of the gun. I suspect not. But the point is, you know, you can do serious injury to that. It does boggle the mind that people who one would imagine would receive some sort of firearms training in MK would not be aware of this. I have heard that amongst sort of MK veterans, there are those who were trained properly as almost conventional soldiers, and you know, in Soviet drill or whatever. And then there were those who received you know, far more rough and ready rudimentary training, you know, in self defense units. And apparently, it's with the latter group that you're likely to have this sort of problem. But you know, a firearm is not a toy. It's not an extension of your political authority or your penis or whatever the hell you want to. You know, it is a weapon. Its purpose is to inflict damage. You know, to sort of point the thing skyward and let rip. You know, I don't know. It's that kind of special kind of stupid that maybe makes South Africa look almost comprehensible sometimes. And as you say, you know, if there were police officers present instead of watching this happen, well, you know, doesn't that say a whole big lot? You know, words don't come easy to me. But just bear something else in mind. At the moment, there's a push for government to impose all sorts of new restrictions on firearm owners. Really, I have never met a legal firearm owner, you know, the kind of guy who goes and shoots his 9mm at the range, who would be this stupid. And, it is criminal. A bullet has to go somewhere. That's why you don't just summer discharge. And as for those gangsters, I wonder how many of them are using guns that were funneled out of police stocks.
Right. So I think that's another point of the story, which is that I'd be curious to know whether the firearm used was in fact legal, especially if it was an AK-47, which I think you can own legally, but we'll have to see. And the police should investigate. Apparently, the local police have opened. There has a case been a case of attempted murder being opened. Sarah, yeah, we shall see. This is the second day in a row that we're getting a story about the sort of two tiers of our justice system. And one of our comments just kind of comment. One of our commenters just said something about this fact, which is that you know, yesterday, of course, we had Jacob Zuma, who's, shall we say, being given a bit of an easy time, as far as we can tell, on the medical parole side of things. Unless, of course, he suddenly dies, in which case, you know, whoops. Yeah. But, you know, once again, it does seem like we have this two-tier of laws. If a legal firearm owner did anything like that, that would be the end of them. They would lose their license. They maybe would go to jail. And this, you know, the police are there. Maybe something happens. Maybe something doesn't happen. Someone gets hurt. I'd be surprised if we see anything. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think the problem is that it gives lie. It's a real parable for the way the ANC is governing at the moment, because it, on the gun issue, it actually gives lie to the intense persecution, figuratively and maybe literally speaking, of legal gun owners, because they're saying legal gun owners shouldn't have the right to defend themselves. But it doesn't really mean isn't what really concerns the government, because this is exactly a display of what doesn't concern the government, is that its own people who are probably not trained, whose guns may or may not be legal, go on this testosterone-driven idea of a volley. I mean, this isn't the National Guard at Arlington, for God's sake. And the fact that, you know, the science of gravity appears to have been decolonized, it just all fits with how little is being thought through, how little about society the ANC understands, and how much the ANC is prepared to simply tolerate what its own does. I mean, the thing is, you have this volley of shots, so-called. Kemi Mapatswe, I mean, Mapatswe was a cook in the struggle. He lost his arm in unmilitary-related ways. So he's a one-armed cook. I mean, he was not exactly a hero of the people. But, you know, with the ANC, that doesn't seem to matter. It's these grand gestures that sort of give vent to its own sense of self-importance that seem to matter at the end of the day. The fact that literally innocent bystanders could be injured and possibly killed by it wouldn't have struck them for a second, and I don't think they struck the Metro Police. And I think it would take a hell of a lot of pressure to get the upper echelons of the police to really look into what the Metro Police who were there were doing about the situation, which I'm pretty sure will be nothing on both counts.
Terrence, final thoughts.
About 10, 12 years ago, there was a standoff between the police and the Metro cops on the highway, I think on the south side of Joburg.
I remember anyway, this story.
Yeah, they like exchanged shots with each other while motorists, you know, like cowered in fear. Not a single person, as far as I'm aware, and I know a question was asked in the legislature about this, was ever prosecuted or disciplined. Mm.
Yeah, I remember that. I mean, it was Keystone cops with the risk of really dying.
Yeah, no. You know, seriously, look, if you feel that there is some sort of need for a salute, I think there's, you know, it's quite appropriate then to like request the army or the police or whatever to arrange a little honor guard and explain why you want them, and they can come and do it properly.
Also, with blank don't ammunition. Use live ammunition.
Well, yeah, that's the thing, you know, like, jeez, I mean, really, seriously.
But essentially, what it also says is that our military, which has a disgraceful name, and the mobsters that do the same thing are, you know, there's not a great deal of space between them.
Right. All right, let us move on to our last story of today, and we're moving overseas. So we won't be kvetching about South Africa. But, and this is a story about, we've talked a little bit on the show about what's been happening in Afghanistan since the collapse of the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan and the reemergence of the Taliban-led government. And it's coming out that apparently the United States and its allies, so Britain, Germany, all of the NATO countries, spent hundreds of millions of dollars building a database to help the previous Afghan government detect security threats ahead of time. This was a database of all sorts of people who worked for the government. It was also supposed to help the government boost education, fight corruption, provide accountability, and as well as detect people who might be linked to warlords or the Taliban and be able to screen them out from being entering into the armed forces, right? This is the idea of this huge database. Unfortunately, it seems to, according to a article written by the Associated Press, it appears to have fallen into the hands of the Taliban without being destroyed. And since then, people who've previously worked for the Afghan government or with the coalition forces have been receiving threatening phone calls, WhatsApps. People have apparently been going door to door looking for collaborators. This is despite the Taliban saying they're not interested in revenge, which is also what they said in 1996 before they started executing people in stadiums. So the fear also seems to be that this database of basically who was working with the foreigners is going to fall into the hands not only of the Taliban, but also their alleged allies in the Pakistani intelligence services, also known as the ISI. So pretty bad stuff. Terence, let me start with you. What do you make of this? I mean, this is kind of a, you know, I must say I'm not particularly comfortable with any government having massive reams of data on us, but much less a Taliban government.
Well, look, I think you know, a helpful hint to aspiring superpowers when you know, assisting client regimes make sure that you can destroy them before you bolt on them. I think this is the kind of thing that I think will inflict a second round of damage on America's credibility. That it fought this sort of 20-year war trying to capacitate the Afghans to take it over, pulled the rug out from under them by withdrawing their air support and their technicians, and now kind of left this to this wonderful list of information for their enemies to go through at their leisure. I think that the question of personal information management is now a universal one. And although I don't buy into conspiracy theories, and I don't think we're being microchipped or anything like that. In fact, I got my second vaccination tomorrow. He was hoping that it will improve my internet this time. I do think that the impulse by governments across the world to acquire and store information is one that needs to be looked at very skeptically. As you say, I wouldn't like the most benign government to know too much about me. When it comes to the use of technology as a tool for repression, well, you know, the Chinese have that whole social credit system, where essentially they can punish you in real time, you know, based on your purchasing habits or whatever, let alone being some sort of civil libertarian big mouth. In the hands of the Taliban, I think it's unlikely to reach the Chinese surveillance society's sophistication. But I think there will be much sadness at what comes out of this. Very, very tragic indeed.
I think that's exactly right, and it's quite interesting because we've seen how much the world has changed. Back when the Taliban controlled Afghanistan in the 90s, they were like the most low-tech totalitarian regime in the world. They were totalitarian, but they did it without computers or smartphones or anything. And now we're kind of seeing there's been talk of a Taliban 2.0 as somehow being more moderate. Mm. I think that's garbage, but. What isn't garbage is that they've adapted to new technologies. And you mentioned China.
They said your death threat on WhatsApp. I mean.
Right. You know, this is a world of difference. Sarah, your thoughts?
Yeah. What it does bring to mind, and this sort of aggravates the West's failure in this regard, is the fact that Afghanistan's closest ally in the region is Pakistan. I think it was long held, in long before the days of the search for bin Laden, who was found in Pakistan, that the US was capacitating the Pakistani intelligence service, and at the same time, the Pakistani intelligence service, being Pakistan and pretty much anti-US, was working against it. So I think the problem here is that it signals, particularly the US, I think, a naivety about other areas of the world that do not think in the Western way that has partly been responsible for what has ultimately happened. It does not. It attributes its own ideas and its own morality to people who live according to a very, very different moral code. And I think
an ideological framework.
Yeah. A lesson until America starts to, if not better understand, pay attention to the people who do understand. And America's got the experts who do understand how the region operates. I wouldn't venture easily into that region if I were America again. They've got to understand that they are not dealing with the type of people who are the people back home.
Right, the Taliban are not interested in getting a seat at the UN or their poll numbers in particular, I don't think. Anyway, that's for another day. We are out of time, so thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll see you tomorrow on the Daily Print Show. Please support the IRR. You can see it on the banner behind me if you're watching on YouTube. It's 32823. SMS your name to become a friend of the Institute. Anyway, thank you very much, and we'll see you tomorrow.